Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and there was an Urbanite radio story, in this month's Urbanite about the cancer rates in Baltimore, focusing on issues of why we don't treat our cancer patients in a holistic way when we know that depression and things can really affect a person's battle with cancer and more. But it also talked about the disparities that exist between Maryland and the rest of the country, and surprising ones that even though we've kind of lowered our cancer rate, the cancer death rate in Baltimore is 30% higher than the national average. It's one of the things we'll talk about this hour. And why? What is that about, and what's going on in our own community when we have some of the premier medical institutions in the country, from research facilities like NIH in Montgomery County to Johns Hopkins and to University of Maryland here in Baltimore. So we'll explore that with our guests and more, and have you join us here at 410-319-8888 or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We are joined by Dr. Claudia Bocquet, who is director of the University of Maryland School of Medicine's Center for Health Disparities and Bioethics. Dr. Mary Fox, who's Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins School of Bloomberg School of Public Health, and Dr. William Nelson, Director of the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center. And doctors, welcome. Good to have you all
Thank
on the
you.
Program.
Thanks.
Thanks.
So when people read this Urbanite article, I'm sure that one of the first things that jumped out at people is why the death rate is so much higher in Maryland than in many other parts of the country. And what you wrestle with both scientifically and socially about why that exists. Who wants to begin that? Why don't we start right over here, Dr. Claudia Bocquet?
Well, the same factors that affect other communities across the nation in terms of explaining cancer health disparities, as they're referred to by NIH, affect our communities here in Baltimore and in Maryland generally. For example, we know that there's health disparities are, for those who aren't familiar with the language, it's basically that some communities develop and die of certain diseases, as we're talking about today, cancer, at higher rates than other communities. So for Baltimore City, some of the factors that contribute are very complex and they interact with each other. For example, major risk factors and exposures, behaviors that we engage in, tobacco use, alcohol, then family history, lack of access to quality health care, lack of information about the preventability or curability of cancer, lack of access to food, clothing, and shelter, which takes the priority over early detection and prompt treatment for diseases such as cancer. So it's very complex. We know a great deal. Now it's time for us to apply what we know in partnerships with communities.
Well, another way to look at it is, people talk a lot about the genes and the genome revolution and whatnot. And you can clearly assign maybe a third of all cancers to a very strong inherited predisposition to perhaps develop a cancer. But another way to look at it, as Claudia Bocquet was saying, at least 80% or more of cancers in this community, in this country, are caused by lifestyles and exposures, as she's described. And you say, well, wait a minute, 80 to 90%, 30% doesn't add up to 100%. Even most of the genes that we're talking about are genes that increase or genes that affect the way you respond to these exposures, your dietary habits, whether you smoke or not, and these kinds of things. And I think what we have in Baltimore is a gene pool. We have a representative of much of the country, but we have lifestyles and exposures that we need to get control of that are driving our people to develop cancer and an infrastructure that's leading them to suffer the worse with it.
What that last statement mean, though? I mean, what do you mean? Are there lifestyles in Baltimore different than lifestyles in Cleveland or in St. Louis or Seattle?
I think the lifestyles aren't particularly different in urban centers, but when we're talking about Baltimore, I think some of the lifestyles in urban America are somewhat different than lifestyles elsewhere. The diet, the way we cook and prepare food, whether we smoke cigarettes or not, are substantially different. And these are the drivers of our most common and major cancers and the ones that exhibit among the highest disparities for race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status.
And the work you do, Dr. Mary Fox, is looking at environmental factors. And we were talking before we went in about how this playing off of what both William Nelson and Claudia Bocquet said about your end of that research.
Right. So Baltimore is an old city, and it has been an industrial city. And so we deal with, in Baltimore, we have historically some contaminated areas we often refer to those as brownfields,
mm-hmm.
and communities in those areas may potentially be more highly exposed to some of the chemicals that we know are related to increased risk of cancer. But as we've been talking about, there are, of course, many factors that determine any individual's actual development of disease, as we've been discussing. Some of the work that I did, in particular to one area of Baltimore, in the South Baltimore area near Swan Park, where the recent rediscovery of arsenic in the soil. Now, arsenic is one of the chemical carcinogens that we know quite a lot about, and it's a well-known one. So there are certainly pockets and parts of the city where important environmental exposures can contribute to cancer.
Well, another question I have, and folks are calling in now at 410-319-8888. George in Sykesville, you're the first caller up. We're going to come to your call in just a second and bring your calls in as you come in. But I just want to raise some of the issues so you understand what's going on in this conversation and also the questions you may have about your own issues and where you can go and why what's been going on in your family. And we'd love to hear some of these stories from all of you out there, 410-319-8888. But, I mean, one of the things I read in some of the studies preparing for the show is that while there may be other parts of Maryland that have a higher cancer rate than even Baltimore City, the death rate in Baltimore City is so much higher. Now, those, Claudia Baquet, we're dealing with not necessarily medical, even environmental issues here, but we're dealing with very deep social and cultural issues here in terms of the death rates in places and economic issues, class issues.
Yes, absolutely. Fortunately, increasingly, there's great attention being placed on what is labeled now social determinants of health, where people live, what type of employment they have, whether or not they have a certain level of education, all influence not only their cancer-related behaviors, their risk exposure. We know those that have less, smoke more, drink more, have less health insurance, have limited what we call material resources. So they're really focused on what they use their resources for, and that could be for the children, sending them to school, after-school activities, avoidance of crime in high crime areas. Mm. Instead of going out at night when you're an hourly wage earner to get a screening test. It just doesn't compute in communities that are highly underserved, particularly in urban areas.
And lack of access to health care, which
yes.
is almost so mind-boggling to think about when we live in this age. We just battle a health care bill in the United States Congress, and we have Johns Hopkins and University of Maryland and all the other hospitals in this area, that we have this kind of lack of access to health care is still kind of mind-boggling, I think.
Yes, lack of access and lack of availability of what's called culturally competent care.
Which means what?
It means that simply providing a health insurance card doesn't mean that a person will use the health care system appropriately. They'll need some skills in how to navigate it, and it doesn't necessarily mean that the type of care they're receiving is tailored for the cultural influences on their health. So culture and economics. So if the counseling is to, you know, stop eating so much saturated fats, cut down on your red meat, but there's no grocery stores in the area with affordable lean meats. There's no training on how to do food preparation that cuts down some of the cancer risks, you know, trim the meat, not so much fat back in the greens.
Right.
And don't overcook the greens, which destroys a lot of the vitamin contribution that could be cancer protective. So I think that, you know, we're addressing these issues. There are problems at multiple levels. Fortunately, I believe that there's some models now available where the community can take action in partnership with academic institutions to address and solve these problems. And fortunately, too, the federal agencies and the private sector are investing in those community academic partnerships that are bidirectional, not simply academia telling the community what's good for you, which often those interventions will not be adopted, but working with the community for what's real and what the community sees are their needs.
So a very specific example, the death rate among African-American men with prostate cancer is twice that of Caucasians, and there just is no reason this needs to be true. If you look at African-American men and Caucasians on clinical trials for prostate cancer, so you know they got the same treatment and they got the correct treatment, those disparities disappear. So this is a function of our health system. This is the ability to access it and navigate it, as Claudia has described, and it just shouldn't be true. We need to fix it.
And it's also the fact that if people don't have access to regular health care, so they don't have a regular prostate exam, so the detection of prostate cancer can be further down in terms of its in its stage of cancer than it would be if somebody middle class, be they black, white, Asian, or Latino, goes to the regular doctor and gets a checkup.
Some of the most needy, because of their lifestyle and habits, socioeconomic status, race, ethnicity in this country, are the last to benefit from screening and early detection and these kind of things that have improved outcome for the rest of the country. Absolutely.
Let's see what our listeners want to talk about. And we have a lot to walk through here this hour. And we're going to bring up a great many issues here during the course of the hour as we look at the issue of cancer in our communities. 410-319-8888. Dr. Claudia Baquet is with us, Director of Maryland School of Medicine Center for Health Disparities and Bioethics. Dr. Mary Fox, an Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And Dr. William Nelson, Director of the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And George, in Sykesville, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, George.
Yes. Three cheers for the Bloomberg School of Public Health and this issue. I worked for the city between 1974 and 1980 around all the housing projects, Fairfield, Cherry Hill, Lafayette, Lexington Terrace. You and I know all the names. And even the trees going down Caroline Street got shorter as you went down to the harbor. And I asked our landscape engineer why that was. They said, because the haze. Routinely in Fairfield, up till like a decade ago, they didn't evacuate those people whenever there were the major league spills and aerosol dispersants in Fairfield. Baltimore has a uniquely nasty industrial history. The samples from our sediments in the Inner Harbor are used as a worldwide standard to measure pollution. And I salute the doctors for saying the awful truth. Our healthcare system just does not, is not efficient and is not as humane as all of your practitioners want it to be. It's something really, really, really has to change.
George, so let's focus on a couple of things you said, because I do want to come to some of the environmental issues and some reading I've been doing during the course of the week, kind of get ready for this, but I to rethink some of the things from our past shows. But the issue George raised at the end about our healthcare system not being humane enough to deal with this. Let's ask the three of you to wrestle with that one. The two of you represent major treatment institutions, and you know all three of you actually. I mean, you're doing treatment at public health necessarily, but let's talk about. But you study those kinds of things. So let's talk about that. I mean, your sense that people don't feel that they're treated humanely, and we don't kind of take the length and breadth of a human being when we're treating them.
Well, I think
William Kimmel. William Kimmel. William Nelson from Kimmel.
I think that one of the sort of the more holistic views that you're sort of moving toward a little bit, I think is very important in cancer and in almost all of our major health maladies. I think we're reaching the point where we have tools in which we can estimate someone's risk to develop a problem, whether it's diabetes, whether it's kidney problems, whether it's cancer and the like, and inform them better with a cholesterol test, blood pressure tests, and the whatnot. But we're honing in on things in which, as Claudia was talking about, the collaboration between patient and physician to remain well, that the goal of the health system is to keep people well for as long as possible. Many of the things we're talking about are the most difficult that we've encountered, which are changing behaviors. It's very hard for someone who's been a chronic smoker to stop smoking. We know that. It's been very difficult to get them to heart.
I was a chronic smoker for a while.
It is very hard to change dietary patterns. And Claudia talked about some of the things. Just even if someone was willing to try, do they have the availability of different dietary constituents that they can purchase and they can cook? So I think we're moving into this thing to, with wellness promotion, where I think is where our health system is headed nationally and hopefully here in Baltimore. But we're also now talking about the hardest problems, which are changing behaviors. And this is going to have to be a collaborative enterprise.
And also, is it also in some ways, Claudia Baquet and Mary Fox, a question of changing the behaviors of the institutions themselves?
Yes.
And how institutions treat patients and people.
And value. If individuals or communities feel they're being treated inhumane, then it is incumbent upon us to respect and value their opinion. I think that if you look at the history of research and what's called research ethics in this nation, which we deal with the Bioethics Research Center, which is funded through a grant, we know that, for example, one of the contributors to disparities, cancer disparities, is the low participation of underserved communities, including African Americans, and that occurs also in Baltimore City, in clinical trials. In clinical trials being medical research studies to look at new ways to prevent or diagnose, treat disease, or enhance quality of life, say, for cancer patients. So why is that? Why is there such distrust, public distrust of research in the health care system? It's been traditionally because the delivery of health care and opportunity for community engagement to solve health problems has been on kind of the lower side. And now, fortunately, we have national initiatives. We have initiatives in Maryland, in Baltimore, that is elevating the contributions the community plays to their own health. That means what we call bidirectional partnership. The community has a role. The academics have a role. It's not the academics telling the community what's good for them. And with bidirectional partnerships, which I insist on, both parts of the partnership grow. Some of the public distrust, too, comes from prior to the establishment of federal regulations that protect individuals that participate in medical research or clinical trials. So, for example, historical concerns such as the Public Health Service study of untreated syphilis in Macon County, Alabama, has a great influence, even to this day, on trust in researchers. And so it's incumbent upon us. We, obviously, as an academic institution, we have a certain level of expertise, but it's now incumbent upon us to translate what we know into interventions at a level that's literacy appropriate and appropriate for communities to really take action. It's the only way to build trust, not only in research, but in the healthcare delivery system.
I'm going to probe that a bit more, but I want to hear what Mary Fox has to say before we go back to the phones.
Oh, I'm sorry. I really have to defer to my colleagues.
Okay, that's fine. 410-319-8888. Ben in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. It's great to hear you back on the air. I'm head of Genesee School. We spoke
yes.
years ago. Yes. Mm-hmm. First, I want to thank you for doing this. And really, coming from L.A. and, you know, Los Angeles, I really want to speak to the person who spoke about environmental and how important that is. When I first moved here, I was shocked when I walked into the restaurant just to even eat, the lack of appropriate food choices that you even had on the menu. And I really feel that being an educator, that all these initiatives are great, but we really need to start teaching children at a very early age. And I was totally appalled when I was in Baltimore City to see the free lunch program of what was actually on those lunches versus what students in L.A. who were on free lunch received with fruits and vegetables. And I just want to know if there are any initiatives in that sense for Baltimore. And the second point I just want to ask out of curiosity, just about the cancer rates, I am stunned at the amount of brain cancer that I hear about in this city. Is that a type of cancer that is unique to Baltimore, or is it in line with the rest of the country? So, one, I wanted to make the point about education, and two, I was asking the question specifically about brain cancer.
Well, I'd like to go back to your comments on environment, and then we'll follow up on the brain cancer question. So, you've touched on an important aspect of a quote-unquote environment. What are the environmental causes of cancer? My own focus is on chemical contamination, and such as the Swan Park example, the asbestos contamination from a former pesticide production plant in that area. But you've also identified that there are broader definitions of environment that include diet, and these relate to some of the behavioral and lifestyle influences on cancer that we've been talking about. I'm afraid I'm not aware of any educational programs that relate to sort of the broader definition of environment that would relate to the school lunch programs or anything like that. So I might defer to my colleagues if they know of programs like that and to follow up on your brain cancer question.
Well, I did go to Maryland Cancer Council meeting where we met the person trying to introduce fresh fruits and vegetables into the
diet. Tony Girassi.
Yeah, it was a fabulous presentation for all the correct reasons. One way to look at it is you eat a couple of pounds of food a day. It's the most complicated chemical mixture on the planet, millions of different individual chemical compounds, and that's before you cook anything. And we've learned that some cooking practices, you overcook red meats. For instance, you make things that cause breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer in rats that can't be good for us. And many of these things appear, Claudia was talking about a classic Southern cooking strategy where you use pork fat that has all of these things and then cook your healthy food in it, your greens, in the pork fat that has these carcinogens. Not
death.
A very good idea. So to educate people in a collaborative way about this is going to take a lot of work. And I think it's a very serious issue that we should take very seriously.
I think you'll see in the fall some formal announcements and citywide partnerships dealing with school-age children and nutrition and physical activity, which would incorporate the school lunch program. But I think it's coming, and it's coming very quickly.
I mean, one of the things we – oh, go ahead.
Oh, just a quick point for your caller. Brain tumors are not out of control numbers-wise in Baltimore, although we are a major treatment center of excellence. There may be a number of people benefiting from treatment around here, but it's not out of proportion here to other places.
Just also an aside to our listener, I mean, people are addressing the issue of what our kids eat, at least in our schools. They're trying to in a very serious way. But there is a problem, and this might not tie directly to cancer, but there are things like – the new studies coming out saying that one out of three children who are born today will develop diabetes. One out of two of African-American and Latino children will develop diabetes. And if you can probably extrapolate out of that other research about what other kind of possibilities may exist, I mean, it's a real – diet and environment are very serious issues when it comes to what we develop in terms of diseases as we get older.
And the point you're making is so critical in that these behaviors or risk exposures relate to a multiplicity of diseases. It's not just cancer. So, you know, the high rate of childhood obesity or certain communities' obesity rate relates to diabetes, hypertension, all kinds of diseases, as well as certain cancers.
And even when these things aren't causing cancers, the people who suffer with cancers who have these other health problems greatly complicates cancer treatment, and they don't do as well.
Now, what about the we were talking about a little earlier, and I think the term you used, Dr. Baquet, was bidirectional partnership.
Those both ways. All the partners benefit. All the partners share responsibility.
But there's something that I think happens classically with some physicians and patients, which is that when you let me just call a couple of things out and see what you think, all three think about this. I mean, that A, you've got issues where I think some physicians don't consider the intelligence of their patients, especially poor patients, especially black patients. There's a disconnect often, and a fear of the physician from the other side because they're not taking them seriously, or what they have seriously. And the other is the whole issue of that relates to that of the question of a holistic approach to someone, let's say you've diagnosed with cancer, and the research that's gone into showing the levels of stress and how that can complicate cancer treatment, or how depression itself comes with the notice that you have cancer, and how if that's not treated, and often because a physician who's dealing with cancer is focused on the breast cancer and focused on how do I get this cancer out of this woman's breast, and not on the issues that she may be facing psychologically. But those are issues I think that are really critical in terms of how we treat cancer in our society, in our city, in our communities, in Maryland.
No, I agree. I think that there's become better and better understanding of these dimensions of care among people who have developed cancer. And I think in our significant treatment centers at the University of Maryland, at our cancer center, we've deployed these kind of assets in a more and more culturally sensitive way that interacts and provides these services more effectively. This has not been widely deployed across many of the, you know, private practices and the like. Has really not worked out that well. So the accessibility of these services is very, I think, more limited than it should be. Wouldn't you say, Claudia?
Yeah, yeah. You called it holistic, and it's multidisciplinary. There are many different people on the team. There are nurses that deliver and support psychosocial services to deal with depression after a diagnosis, after therapy, and even issues related to sexuality after having a cancer diagnosis. So I think there's increasing, because of advocates' pressure, you know, support group and survivor group pressures, patients who have had cancer and have had these issues and unmet needs. So I think there's a greater attention to it in larger centers. But I think it needs to be integrated as a routine part of care.
Well, one other point in this domain is, you know, there's a wonderful epidemic in one way arising, and that is of people who have lived through having a cancer that they've accumulated to the tune of 13 or 14 million across the country. Increasingly, people are living a long time after cancer. Cancer treatment has improved. And so this survivorship, these people have unique health concerns, unique health challenges, getting back to work, reengaging in their life, their full life, sexuality, their partners, their community and whatnot has become very challenging. And this group was, I think, becoming forgotten as they were being generated. But I think there's a lot more effort and focus on them now.
We're about approaching time for a break. And rather than try to squeeze a caller in here in a minute and a half, Fran and Marilyn, you're the next caller up. Then Kevin, we'll go to your call. Number here is 410-319-8888. We're looking at the high cancer death rates in the state, in Baltimore specifically, why they exist. But also we're going to begin to explore and talk about the progress that's been made and how that's been made in Maryland and why it's a unique thing here in the state. Stay with us, 410-319-8888. And we'll look at some environmental issues that we have questions for Dr. Mary Fox and the rest as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're having another one of our Urbanite Radio discussions. We're talking about cancer in our community. We have joining us in studio Dr. Claudia Paquet, who is Director of University of Maryland School of Medicine Center for Health Disparities and Bioethics, Dr. Mary Fox, Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and Dr. William Nelson, Director of the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center, 410-319-8888. And as I promised, go right to the phones. Fran in Maryland, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark and everybody. How you doing?
Well, Fran, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to make a few comments about what you guys were talking about, and then I'd like to have you answer a question or two for me.
Okay.
I think that you, in the last couple of days, Mark, you had a chef on your show a couple of days ago about the nutrition and the local stuff.
He was Tony Gerassi was the head of the program in the Baltimore City Public Schools, turning around how our children eat in those schools.
Right, yep. Exactly. Yep. And what you're talking about today about cancer and how all that goes. I've had cancer in my family, and I remember growing up in the public school system. You know, we had a lot of bread and sugar in our diet. And I had a lot of yeast infections growing up, even before I, you know, got intimate with men and those types of things. And that was from the nutrition that I was getting from the school system. And I think we are conditioned when we are from little kids on up. And I remember the comment you said your little 13-year-old made about, you know, blah to the food that's
right.
In school,
right.
You know?
Right.
Locally grown growers, I know, with Silver Diner have changed their menus to where they're now using the locally grown foods.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know, you know, why can't we fix this nutritional problem starting in our system with the school lunch programs to where we can work with the local growers to do just exactly that and have nutritionally sound meals for our kids?
Well, that's an issue that I'm not really tackling today, but just so much. But I think it is an issue that does relate to this question of diet, cancer, and what we feed our kids, and and what we know about that.
Well, I think if you took all the sort of studies, and there's been many, about diet and cancer, you just can't go wrong by eating fruits and vegetables. I can't think of any other way to put it. Vegetables are very healthy for you. They help prevent many cancers. They make you healthier if you get a cancer, and I think that's one way to look at it.
Any thoughts from our panelists?
Amen.
That is a show we'll come back to. I think that that's. And I think that there's been a lot of conversations about and arguments about cancer and health, cancer and diet, what you eat, how that can bring certain cancers on, and also the prevention of cancers, and that people argue with certain foods that you can eat, and also the people argue about what you can eat once you do have cancer. I mean, those are all kinds of issues I think that are on the table, and physicians don't always agree about these things.
No.
410-319-8880. We'll come back to calls in a minute. I want to come back to this issue that came up earlier before we talk about how things have changed in Maryland, which has to do with the environmental issues. I mean, I mentioned a bit about it in the green room before we went on, and we had folks here from Sparrows Point on the show the other day talking about their battle with the companies that own the steel mills to clean up the toxicity around them, and the high cancer rates that they think they have in Sparrows Point, and especially in Turner Station, which is historically a black community in that area where these toxic wastes have been dumped. And talking a bit about what we don't seem to get to often enough, and it's a very difficult subject to tackle for numbers of reasons, which is the question of the environmental factors in cancer. Talk a bit about what you and your colleagues are kind of wrestling with and researching in this area.
Well, there are a number of things to say. One aspect of doing small area community type studies is that it's very difficult to study them rigorously because of the small numbers. I mean, if it's a relatively small community, it's sort of hard to get statistical significance in any kind of research you might do. There's also challenges with the nature of cancer. Many cancers have a very long latency, so an exposure that occurs a very long time ago may contribute to someone developing cancer later in life. And so because of those long latency periods, it's very difficult to actually identify the exposure that was important. If I could maybe talk a little bit about Swan Park, there was good news in the work that I did related to Swan Park and the South Baltimore neighborhood, and the study was developed with the health department, and in fact, what I found there was it leads to hopefully some of the good news and the progress that we will be talking about in a few minutes, that. Many of the most common cancers, so I looked at four, lung and bronchus, colorectal, breast, and prostate. And for colorectal, breast, and prostate cancer, the rates in South Baltimore are actually lower than the city, the state, and the nation. For lung cancer, however, the rates were higher. And, there are multiple environmental contributors to that, possibly the Swan Park, the arsenic exposure from the pesticide plant that was there, but also occupational exposure is very important. The shipbuilding was historically an important occupation on the waterfront in Baltimore and in the South Baltimore area, and so the cancers we're seeing now may in part relate back to people's occupational exposures quite a long time ago. So that's another one of the complications in studying environmental cancers.
This is something that I know that I'm just curious how this grabs the three of you, since you're so deeply involved in issues around cancer and kind of finding the root of this. There's just some stats I just read that aren't directly related, but I think they may be. I'm just curious what you think. I was reading about Cancer Alley, which is this area between Baton Rouge and New Orleans that which has one of the highest cancer rates in the nation, where we have 7 oil refineries and 175 heavy industrial plants that exist in this area, similar to Sparrow's Point, but much more intensely than what we have in that area. And then I was really shocked that we have over 80,000 synthetic chemicals registered for use in the United States of America, 80,000. And of those 80,000, only 7% have any toxicological screening data at all. We don't know what they have. So while we were talking in the green room, Nelson, about how difficult it is to kind of get to doing certain kinds of research because the percentage of people we study are small, and it's very difficult to kind of extrapolate out of that kind of larger data. But we're not even kind of going to what could be the root to even understand the chemicals that are in our environment, even to begin to wrestle with what may be causing such high cancer rates and breast cancer, other kind of cancers in this country.
Well, I've been hoping that that the field that studies this undergoing the same type of technological revolution as some of the genomics is, so that we can figure out what these compounds are using mass spectroscopy, lots of high-end kind of equipment, but use it for the social purpose to figure out what they are, who gets exposed to them, how they're metabolized and handled, and by identify them, can we assess whether they have the propensity to cause cancer in mice? That's not a good thing. What is the danger and who gets exposed and how much did you get exposed to, and sift through these and figure out which ones are dangerous and get control of them, clean up these areas, I think is what we need to do.
Could I weigh in? Policy hat on for a second. So, I mean, there are some underlying policy reasons why we don't have good data on so many of these chemicals. And I think, in fact, one of the things that our U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is doing now is a review of our Toxic Substances Control Act. And so maybe we will have some better policy infrastructure going forward to get better data on things we don't know.
I think from a policy, I have to weigh in because I'm from New Orleans.
Please, I know you are.
And you've seen, the whole world has seen issues related to New Orleans, weather-related, and then what happens after, and who gets services, how fast there's an investment or not. So the policy issues, the social determinants of health, there is, as you said, there's tremendous cancer burden in that region of the country, in Louisiana, New Orleans, and, you know, the Baton Rouge belt.
And this is a kind of a political question, so I know it's sensitive for you all because of the work that you do, and I'm going to put you in a difficult spot, but I'll just raise the issue. I mean, that when you look at the money the National Cancer Institute has given out over the years for research, if you just take breast cancer, for example, which is close to $800 million worth of research money put out for breast cancer by the NCI over a two-year period, 2002-2003. Actually, it's called over $900 million. Only 11% of that money went into studying any environmental factors when it comes to breast cancer. It was all genetic research and molecular biology, which are important. I'm not saying there's not important issues to study, but the questions of where we invest the money and how much gets invested in looking at factors outside of genetics is given some way short shrift. I'm just tying that to the whole question of not even studying the chemicals from the beginning to begin to maybe round out our understanding of what could be causing the cancer rates in our country and in our communities here in Maryland.
Well, I could take one crack at that. One of the things I think that we needed to learn, and I think are learning and have largely learned, is that clearly a lot of breast cancer is caused by exposure, overexposure, that it's driven by the female hormones, estrogen. There are compounds, toxins and whatnot in the environment that have estrogenic properties. That's one way to look at how they may or may not be dangerous. But the other set with the investment in genetics and stuff is we've learned that breast cancer isn't breast cancer isn't breast cancer. It's a series of several diseases. There's a breast cancer that's more common in African-American women in urban centers that doesn't seem to be driven by the female hormone. And now that we know that that cancer is different, this is the kind of thing we need to look at and say, what are the factors that are driving this kind of breast cancer? There's great interest in figuring this out, as distinct from the larger breast cancer, a lot of it driven by the female hormone. And you heard a little bit in what Dr. Fox was talking about, smoking and lung cancer. Smoking was the, you know, right, 60-ton gorilla in the room. But there are other things that can contribute to lung cancer. So as we begin to look at lung cancer as a series of different diseases, there are some lung cancers that we know arise in people who aren't smokers. What was the cause of that lung cancer? Can we figure that out?
Okay, then we'll go back to the phones here.
I spent 8 wonderful years at the National Cancer Institute as a senior scientist and then went to Health and Human Services before coming to the university. And the policy shifts that I've seen in terms of the allocation of research dollars that are so apparent to me, besides the genomics, are the heavy investment that NIH is making on research to come up with the appropriate way to mobilize communities to deal with a host of health disparities. This is very unusual from when I was at the NIH as a scientist. And so, you know, I can't comment on the allocation for environmental. I don't know that. But I certainly know the multi-millions of dollars they're investing in what NIH says is fostering public trust in research, supporting research literacy, supporting health literacy, so that all of these advances, that disconnect that exists now between discovery and delivery, that disconnect can be eliminated. So I've seen the policy shift, and I've applied for the grants and had the community. The community has applied for some of these grants and have been successful. That was unheard of when I was a scientist at NIH. So I've seen that
major. Things are moving in the right direction.
Absolutely, yes.
Let's reopen the phones here, 410-319-8888, and Mackenzie in Canton, you're on the air.
Hi,
Mackenzie.
I just had a quick question. What are your thoughts on any theories of the high cases of cancer being related to the close proximity to the Chesapeake Bay here in Maryland?
Anything there?
It is an exceptionally accurate statement. If you try and look at everything, our race, ethnicity makeup, our dietary patterns and whatnot, there is still an excess cancer risk around the Chesapeake Basin, not just in Maryland, but around Virginia and the like. Our assumption, at least mine, is Dr. Fox, she's an expert in this area. My assumption with this is related to the post-industrial character of this region and that there are other things that we need to discover and get out of the land and the water. But am I right?
Well, that I'm not familiar with the greater region. I guess my work has mostly been related to Baltimore's waterfront, and that's certainly true. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, I think there's many of the urban brownfields of former industrial sites that are contaminated lie around our waterfront. So that, you know, makes sense in that respect.
There are two investigators looking at in the Delmarva area some of the contributions to cancer in contaminants in the oil, in the air, and in the water. And Dr. Kathy Squibb and Dr. Ali Ishak at UMES have been studying that for the last probably 6 years and have come up with some interesting findings, which they're about to publish.
Our new Delmarva show coming in the fall. We'll have to talk to them.
Yes.
410-319-8888. Louise in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Louise.
I'm calling. I actually have 3 questions for your panel of experts. Mm-hmm. One is if they could address the fact that cancer, my understanding of cancer is that it can be related more to exposures than to genetics, and that exposures can affect genes. So I'd like to have their comments on that. The second is that you were talking about the dollars that we're putting into research, and we actually know there are a lot of known carcinogens, and shouldn't we be redirecting some of those dollars towards implementing removing those carcinogens from the known carcinogens from our environment? And then the third point is that we have one of the largest medical waste incinerators right here in Baltimore. We have one of the largest medical waste incinerators in the country right here in Baltimore. And the focus of your show was on why Baltimore has 30% higher than average rate of cancer deaths. And so could the medical waste incinerator be a contribution to that? And I work with a program called Maryland Hospitals for Healthy Environment, And we are working with hospitals to reduce their waste, among many other greening initiatives. But one of the biggest ones is reducing their waste, especially their toxic waste that's going to the medical waste incinerator. So I wanted to have their comments on incineration as well.
Interesting questions.
Well, I guess let me try to at least begin to address the issue of exposure and genetic relationships. Cancer is a multifactorial disease process, and all of these factors come into play. Genetics may make someone more susceptible to a particular exposure, and so for that person, a small exposure, may increase their risk of cancer. But it is a multifactorial, multidimensional process, and I'm not sure that we can say accurately at this point what percent is caused by, how can we attribute this percent of cancer to X exposure, this percent of cancer to, Y genetic factor. Perhaps my colleagues here can address that one a little bit better. On your second point about removing known carcinogens, you're touching on something that I would call sort of the precautionary principle. When we do know that something is toxic, is a bad actor, shouldn't we be able to, let's take steps now to reduce our exposures? And that's absolute. I would absolutely agree with you. But this also is a matter of some changing the way we do environmental policy and the way we do regulation. I'm not an expert on the medical waste incinerators, so I'm not sure I can really address your comment on
either.
That. Yeah,
but I think that's an interesting thing for us to look at. Some other points, I'm not really sure the answer to that at all.
I can add one thing to the discussion about the genes and exposure. It's actually a nuance in your questioner that sounded quite informed. And from a high altitude, you can say at least 85% of cancers have a significant exposure component when you include diet, lifestyle, and everything else. But cancers themselves are diseases of acquired defects in genes, and they can be changes in the gene sequence. The genes form the blueprints for all the components of the cells in the body. If these sequence, the blueprints are corrupted, the components don't function right, the cancer grows wildly. But one of the things that is at the cutting edge of cancer research at the moment is there are differences in the way the genes are used. People call epigenetics. And one of the things that we're learning about epigenetics is that these are acquired defects in genes that are very carefully coupled with some of these exposures. And so we heard about there may be a long latency. Well, one of the things we're wondering is that long latency marked by an epigenetic change that perhaps in the future we might be able to measure, that is a corruption in the way the genes work that sets the stage for cancer development later? And I think this epigenetic thing is here in Baltimore, actually at Maryland and at Hopkins, is one of the places that really have brought this up the flagpole better than anywhere else in the world. And hopefully we can figure this out.
That's fascinating. That's really interesting. I before we go, Rodney, the next caller up, but I wanted to come to a place I said we were going to come to, which is to talk about for a minute, despite the kind of huge death rate we have here in our community, and that we're actually one of the highest mortality rates in the country, there's been improvement from earlier periods in both these rates. And we were talking about that during the green run. I'd like you to talk a bit about that.
Yeah, I think if you look 20 years ago, Maryland as a state, Baltimore as a city, we were in really bad shape. Maryland was the second worst state for cancer deaths in the United States. And
you say after D.C. is that
after D.C., which isn't even a state, and might as well be in Maryland also.
Right.
And the good news is since about 2000, the state of Maryland used their cigarette tobacco settlement funds and invested a substantial amount of them, not enough to our taste, but a substantial amount of them, in trying to solve this problem, both through research and through bringing these screening and other services to the people who most needed them. This is how I got to know Dr. Baquet over the years. And in Baltimore City, Johns Hopkins, University of Maryland, we focused on screening for prostate cancer, breast cancer, cervical cancer, colorectal cancer, and the like. And it's starting to pay off. We are out of the top 10 in all the major cancers now. And as a state, we're 22nd. And it's a list we want to be 50th on, or 51st, I guess, if we're including D.C. But we've made huge progress in the last decade, mostly by doing it. We have to do it.
Yeah, the tobacco settlement investment really, really shored up a lot of our activities. Not only did it allow us to directly put these programs and research in motion, but it allowed us also to bring the community in to be part of the solution, design some of the programs, and leverage that tobacco settlement money that the state invested in us for larger federal money to expand even greater our activity. So it was a fantastic investment in and very wise, and has paid off in terms of reduced cancer mortality.
I think I have to ask the follow-up of this, is Dr. Baquet, I'll let you start off with this, is the question of what has to be done to lower the mortality rate among African-American in this community and in Maryland, especially poor people? Because, I mean, we always say African-Americans, but we're talking about poor people for the most part that are adversely affected in terms of the mortality rates in our society. I mean, I think all of you are kind of just pondering from what really has to happen to end that? It almost sounds like equality of mortality sounds ridiculous, but something that brings us to a place where people are not dying for reasons that they should not be dying for.
It requires an ongoing investment. It requires a multi-level approach, because the problems don't just happen at one level. So, yes, additional research is needed, but we also have to build infrastructures and support community organizations and neighborhoods so that they can become part of the process that yields the solutions. You also have to support policy research. For example, we've worked very closely with our elected officials and provided technical assistance to support investments of funding for low-income women and breast cancer screening, diagnosis, and treatment. So you have to focus at the community level, infrastructure. You have to focus research. You have to bring the community in at every stage. You have to leverage the money for sustainability, because once you get the momentum gone, if the funding goes, it's just very unfair to the community and to all the efforts that we start. You have to work with elected officials so the policies respond to what the science and the data say. And then the community plays a role in that, in advocacy, which is critical, such as many of the community organizations in Baltimore were very active in doubling the state tobacco tax. They met with their elected officials. Many of the communities, you know, across the state, but including in Baltimore, went to their elected officials about and supported the Clean Indoor Act. All types of legislation. So the State Office of Health Disparities and Minority Health, Children and Families Initiatives. Because you'll find, as you mentioned earlier, the holistic approach to disparities, although we're focused on cancer, often in communities who are particularly underserved, they don't want to just focus on cancer. Or, you know, they say, well, why can't you just do something for me or with me,
right,
for my hypertension, for my diabetes? And we'll talk about cancer that may occur in some years or may be at greater risk, but also on provision of quality food for my children and avoidance of violence. So it takes a holistic, multi-level approach with investment and community engagement so that the community helps design the solutions.
I really want to appreciate the three of you taking your time. I know you three are extremely busy human beings in the work that you do. To take the time with our listeners here on the Mark Steiner Show here on WEA, Dr. Claudia Baquet from the University of Maryland, Dr. Mary Fox from the Bloomberg School of Public Health, William Nelson from Johns Hopkins. Thank you so much for being here today and contributing to this program.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a pleasure. You're welcome. Thank you.
This is one of our Urbanite Radio discussions. It was inspired by the Urbanite article this in this month's issue called The Good Fight by Matt Edelson. Cancer patients gain guidance, inspiration from a new breed of patient navigators. So you've been listening to our Urbanite Radio stories, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbanitesBaltimore.com. We'll take a very brief break, come back to Your Money Matters to find out what's going on with women with pre-existing conditions and why they have or their abortion rights are being limited in America again. Don't ask, don't tell. Is it over? Is it coming? Is it not? And then Shotoka, the beatboxer, who performs the BSO. And at the end, you'll hear a little duet between the beatboxer and Steiner, the throat singer. We'll be right back. Stay with us.